Okay, good evening, everyone. This is class number 4 out of 6 in the Discovering Buddhism module, Mind and Its Potential. Just want to remind people, there is no class next Monday night, okay? Absolutely no class. We'll be empty of class next Monday night. And then we have two more classes, the following two Mondays. The first, next one will be more didactic material. And then the last one, we'll do some question and answers, but it will be primarily a practice evening during the, in the same time frame from 7 to 8:30. So let's see. Do we have anyone who's here for the first time tonight? Okay. Great. Yeah, glad to have you here. Welcome. We'll do a little bit of review, so hopefully you can pick up something. Hope you find it useful. So, we're going to start with some meditation. The Tibetan definition of meditation. What's the word meditation mean in Tibetan? Gom. To become familiar with. To become familiar with the contents of our mind, and to become familiar and particularly with the virtuous contents of our mind, so that they can increase. And we're working with that non-physical aspect of our being, the mind. The posture is not the point of the meditation by a long shot, but we try and establish a posture that is stable and non-distracting so that we're not paying attention to our posture, not worrying about it and fidgeting with it during the meditation. So the most important aspect of the posture is that our back is straight, a little bit straighter than we normally sit, not rigid, but just a little bit straight. And that's said to open up the energy channels. There are thousands of them in the body, according to Tibetan physiology. You can't find them if you, excuse me, dissect the body, but there are these channels, and it said what's referred to as the winds, the energy of the body travels in these channels, and it said that the mind or the consciousness actually rides those winds. So we want them nice and open to help with the meditation. So our back is straight. If we're sitting on a cushion, sit a little bit towards the front. Don't sit in the middle of the cushion, but sit towards the front edge so your pelvis is opened up. If you're sitting in a chair, it's fine to put a cushion underneath your feet if you find that helps. Don't slouch back in the chair. Our head is straight on our shoulders. Our eyes are lightly closed or just very slightly open. Our shoulders are down and back a little bit so that our chest is opened up. Again, that helps to open the energy channels. Our mouth is lightly closed, not clenched. The tongue against the upper ridge of the gums. Our arms are away from our torso so that some air is passing through. And we can either put one hand on each knee or, more traditionally in the Tibetan tradition, right hand on left with the thumbs touching slightly below the level of the navel. So take a moment and check the posture, identify any sources of tension or discomfort now and address them now so they don't become an issue during the meditation, because that's not what we want to become familiar with during this meditation. And just to help settle the mind, take 3 deep breaths with the abdomen expanding on the in-breath, So the diaphragm is pulled down. And then the contracts towards the spine on the exhalation. Three deep breaths like that. And now we allow our breath to return to its normal pattern. And as always, we set our motivation for doing the meditation that is to follow. As much as possible, we generate the bodhicitta motivation, the idea that I am doing this meditation to develop my mind in a way so that I can be of greater benefit to all sentient beings. Seems unnatural to think that way, even grandiose, but just try and generate that motivation, even if it requires effort, even if it's, you have to kind of squeeze it out. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation. The chosen object for the meditation is the breath, the movement of the breath in and out through our nostrils, the physical sensation of breath moving in and out. And we just gently place our mind, our awareness on that mind perceiving movement of the breath. Nothing more than that. Mind on the breath. So that we could almost say that breath and mind become one. And every time we notice that our mind is away from the breath, on a memory or a plan or a physical sensation or various images that just come up, we just set those aside and bring the mind back to the chosen object, the breath. And now we can bring our meditation to an end. And we finish with a brief dedication. We acknowledge ourselves for having done something positive. We can rejoice in that. Acknowledge that some positive seeds have been planted on our mind stream. Very small, but definitely some positive seeds just by sitting quietly like this and working with our mind. And we wish that those seeds not be lost, but they may ripen in the future in a way that benefits all sentient beings. Any questions or comments about that meditation, concentration meditation?
How long was that?
It was about 20 minutes altogether, yeah. Mm-hmm. So a little bit, yeah, stretch our meditation muscles a little bit. Are people getting some comfort or getting a little bit more comfortable with that? Or people just noticing how distracted their minds are? Both valuable observations. Okay. I'm going to start off with some review. This class is on the mind. It's often said that Buddhism is a mind science. Everything in Buddhism is about working with the mind, really. If you want to, I mean, that's a gross generalization, but it's somewhat true. But that's the main goal in Buddhism, is to develop our mind, specifically develop its capacity for compassion and its capacity for wisdom, so that we can become a Buddha, an enlightened being ourselves. That's a possibility for every living being that has consciousness, animals, insects, little microbes, anything that has consciousness, according to the Buddha, has the potential to become enlightened. So we want to develop our qualities of compassion. What's the Buddhist definition of compassion? Is it just a warm, fuzzy feeling in your chest? It's a little bit more specific than that. Anybody know? Yeah. Wanting others to be free from suffering, okay. Wanting others to be free from suffering. Wanting others to be happy is love. Okay, but they're really flip sides of the same coin. And what is wisdom in Buddhism? What are we talking about when we refer to wisdom? Does it mean having read a lot of all these texts here and memorized them all? It's the wisdom of emptiness. But emptiness isn't, that module isn't until 7 or 8 down the line, so it really refers to seeing things as they are, seeing reality without our preconceptions, our judgments, our interpretations plastered over on it. And the Buddha said, you know, you don't even know how misconceived your perceptions of the world around you and of yourself are right now. And that lack of our inability to see things as they are is actually where our suffering comes from, is the source of our suffering. And by implication, the source of others' suffering ultimately comes from their lack of seeing things as they are. So, again, we have to develop both qualities. And they're qualities that we develop in our mind, which was the subject of this class. So since all of Buddhism is working with our mind, we need to get clear on what we're talking about here. And so I said last week, if you don't retain anything from this course but these four things, you'll have done well. So there are three characteristics of the mind and one function. Okay, what's the first characteristic? Non-material, okay? Non-physical, okay? We are not talking about the brain. We are not talking about neurotransmitters. We're talking about that completely non-physical aspect of our being. Okay, that consciousness, that awareness that we have a sense of, but we can't, it's hard to even look at it, hard to even imagine. But we all know what it is because we've experienced it all our life. Okay, it is the non-physical aspect of our being. In the Buddhist interpretation of things, when we're conceived, a consciousness, non-physical, combines, or doesn't combine, but is united temporarily with a physical aspect and goes through life. And at the moment of death, what happens is the consciousness, the non-physical, separates from the physical aspect. The mind leaving the body is what happens at the time of death, according to the Buddha. So we're dealing with that non-physical aspect of our being. We all have it, we're all familiar with it, but it's almost like we're trying to turn our head inside out and look at it. It's one of those things that if you look right at it, you can't see it. Sometimes you have to look over to the side. Non-physical, not the brain, okay. That's its first characteristic, mind. What's its second characteristic? It's without beginning and without end, okay? It has no beginning. And it has no end. No temporal beginning and no end. So this certainly implies past and future lives, or sometimes reincarnation, rebirth. We refer to it, we just say continuity of consciousness. Because from the Buddhist logic, a non-physical phenomena, like our consciousness, is always the result of a previous non-physical phenomena. This moment of consciousness comes from a previous moment of consciousness. From a previous moment of consciousness, there is always a previous moment of consciousness. The Buddha said it's not logical to posit that consciousness just arose out of the void, that my consciousness just began at some time. There's always a previous moment of consciousness that can be traced back, it's said by great meditators, to previous lifetimes, where the consciousness was united with a different physical form. And in the same way, this moment of consciousness leads to another moment of consciousness, to another, to another, to another. And the physical body decays, but the consciousness continues one moment after another. And I gave you a wrong number a couple classes ago. I said, do you know how many moments of consciousness there are in the snap of the fingers? 65, yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so those moments of consciousness, okay, one after another. We see the big ones, the really gross ones, but the very subtle moments of consciousness we're not even aware of yet. But it's one after another after another. You can think of a series of marbles or something. You push, you know, a long line of marbles. Thoughts after another, one bumping into the next, into the next, into the next, into the next. That's an image. You can think about a river. Analogies are good here. You can think about a river flowing, continuous, okay? The molecules of water are changing continuously, but there is a continuity of the river. And each thought that's in that consciousness, that occurs in that consciousness, is said to arise in the consciousness. So you can think, and it comes up, it exists, and it goes out of existence. Then there's another moment of consciousness or another thought that arises. And then another one arises. And the Buddha said, we can't have two moments of consciousness at the same time or two thoughts. We may go back and forth between two very quickly so that they seem simultaneous, but actually we're going back and forth. It's one moment of thought, one moment of thought, one moment of thought. each one arising, existing, and then going out of existence. Arising, existing, and going out of existence. Yeah, question. Let me get you to use the mic, please. Thank you, Patrick.
Not in the previous to that one in meditation, but where we were supposed to meditate on the moments of continuity.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I had a little bit of trouble trying to grasp that and to manage it in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
When you're going through your meditation and something comes up, any thought at all, you just let your consciousness to bring another one in. It has to be connected to it, or it could be something completely disconnected, or you could give me a little bit more of insight.
Yeah, you're not trying to guide the flow of thoughts. You're just looking at what arises. And they will, at times, they'll seem completely random. At other times, they'll seem a very logical progression. But the idea is just to get a sense, a feel for thoughts arising and subsiding, arising and subsiding in this stream of consciousness.
But weren't you trying to go back in time?
No, you're just staying right now in the present, just looking at what occurs in my mind from moment to moment. And like I say, we're not going to see all 65 of them. We're just going to see the grossest ones, okay? But you're just sitting there watching what comes up, whatever it is. Boredom, air conditioning sound, foot on the floor, okay? Whatever comes up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The meditation, watching the thoughts arise without getting involved in anyone, but just looking at the stream of thoughts. Okay? Okay. So, no beginning, no end. You know, I can't say that that's my experience. It seems logical. It's once we get a sense of this non-physical consciousness, it's hard to imagine it going out of existence. It's not me, it's not my personality, but just this non-physical aspect. No beginning, no end. Okay? The third characteristic of mind. Clear light, another way we could say it's clear, it's in the nature of clear light, or it has clarity. Clarity is I don't think I use that word, but that's a good word to use. Clarity. Okay, it's clear light. Clear, uncolored light. And what this is trying to get at is a sense that the mind has no fixed qualities of its own. Okay, that's one of its qualities, that it has no fixed qualities. But the thoughts are not the consciousness. The thoughts occur in this space of clear light. And again, analogies can be useful here. We think about clouds floating through a perfectly clear sky. The clouds being the thoughts, they are passing through the clarity of the mind, but they are not part of the inherent nature of the mind. Venerable George used the word adventitious. They're not part of its real essence. We can use the image of fish swimming in perfectly clear water, with the fish being the thoughts flowing through the mind. But the point is that the thoughts that we think are me, anger, depression, this, that, whatever, are not inherently part of my mind. Those are thoughts arising in that clear light. Okay, just the thought arising, existing. We have habits. We may have defined habits of thinking about ourselves in this way, so that thought tends to occur a whole lot. But it's not part of the inherent nature of the mind, and the fact that the mind has no fixed qualities is what gives us the potential to become enlightened, because enlightenment can arise in that clear space just as well as anger or depression or anxiety arises in it. Complete compassion, complete wisdom can arise there if we train ourselves to think that way. As Venerable Rabina has said many times, Buddhism is just about developing new habits. Okay, habits that work better than the ones we have now. Okay, so that's the third quality of it. And the fourth is the function of the mind. And what is the function of, what does the mind do? It perceives. It's aware of. If you want to be really a serious Buddhist, you can say it cognizes. Can somebody with a computer look up the, what's the actual definition of cognize? Can somebody look that up on their computer or something? I would like to be clear on that myself. Again, these are all translations for Tibetan terms. What? Okay, Susie. Into the mic.
This says perceive,
okay.
Know, or no. Become aware of.
Become aware of. Okay. Okay, so they all mean about the same. I mean, cognize kind of has the implication, yeah, the becoming aware of, okay. The mind is, it cognizes things, okay. It cognizes that blue cup, okay. That's a thought in my consciousness. It cognizes being angry about something. Anger is just something that the mind cognizes. Our emotions, our memories. We cognize, the mind cognizes objects. Okay, hold just a second. All of those are just objects occurring in the mind, that the mind becomes aware of, that it cognizes. And while that thought is in the mind takes on the nature of what it cognizes. Okay, so if we think angry thought after angry thought after angry thought, in essence, our mind becomes angry. Our mind, you know, that's not its inherent nature, but for practical purposes, you know, you can say we are what we think. In the same way, if we think kind, loving, compassionate thoughts, we become what we're thinking. If our consciousness is just a series of moments of compassion and wisdom, that's who we are, in essence. So the Buddha is saying just replace the negative thoughts with the more positive thoughts, and that's all you have to do. How can we tell a thought's negative? Why, that sounds kind of judgmental. What's the way, how can we tell when thoughts are negative? They disturb the mind, it said. They agitate the mind. They're not comfortable. Virtuous thoughts, and again this gets into karma, which will inevitably lead to happiness, feel comfortable. The mind relaxes. Okay? Let's see, there are a couple hands up back here. Yeah, let me get you to use the microphone.
The way you describe consciousness, it sounds like it's in isolation. Don't consciences ever merge?
Not in the Buddhist point of view, okay? My consciousness is separate from your consciousness, okay? They're interdependent, and they certainly affect each other, but there is no merging into any kind of universal consciousness, okay? Each consciousness is a without beginning, without end, but they don't all merge into some collective soup, okay? But we are interdependent. That's not really the subject of this class. But that's one of the things that we misperceive. We think we're independent, and we're actually quite interdependent. Okay, that's more when we get into talking about karma. So was there another comment or question? Okay, I'll pass the mic behind.
Okay, so I was thinking about that basic quality that we think of as human, being self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that fit in?
Well, define what you mean by self-aware first.
That I exist, that I'm in this occupying space, That there, in my life, there I'm aware that there was a beginning and there will be an end.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. That's a characteristic of being a human, as you say.
Right.
Okay. I don't think, you know, one-cell microbes have much self-awareness. I don't know. Supposedly we've all been at that level, but I can't remember it. Okay, that's why being a human is considered to be such a fortunate rebirth in the Buddhist cosmology, in that we can think about things in that way. And that makes it, it's said we have greater opportunities for spiritual practice when we're human. But thinking that way and being able to talk about this stuff is one of the advantages of being a human being with a semi-functional mind, yeah. Okay. Over here. Up, Patrick, up, yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The first three look to me that are really different to anything physical. But the fourth one, it's close to what we define as brain. Is it not?
Well, the consciousness is related to the brain, certainly, but I don't know if you can... if you dissect the brain, I don't think you can find cognition in there anywhere. You go find neurotransmitters and neural pathways and stuff. But the actual phenomena of cognition, of perceiving, I'm not sure if you can find that. You know, you have to work this out for yourself. Just think about it, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think of it as a non-physical event, cognizing.
Okay.
Yeah,
I thought that those pathways of neuron activity where we store the cognitive images of, you know, this is an apple and whatever. So that's why, because the first three are completely non-related to anything like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just think about it, yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, and you don't have to agree with it. Okay. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, let's see in the back there, please. Yeah, he's got...
Was thinking about the word cognize. It's very difficult for me to come up with a really good definition of what consciousness is. Being unconscious, you know, the absence of something is a little more clear. We're present, our consciousness is present. I guess if I think about the word recognize, which is to cognize something again, it sort of means that I'm familiar with that form, or that I can somehow discern it from the things around me. So maybe to cognize is the ability to say, you know, this is something. Then, of course, you can build on top of that and come to all kind of erroneous conclusions about what it is.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit more tonight, I think. Yeah, the ability to recognize. Okay. So, got that? Everybody's got that, okay? If you don't get anything out of this class, those 4 points. And like I say, you don't have to accept it. This is just the way Buddhism looks at the mind. And it's kind of the basis for everything that's going to follow. Okay. Next thing I want to review is the Buddha gave lots of different models of how we exist. They're all correct. Some are more subtle, some are more elaborate than others, and their different ones work for different people. So talking about how I, Robbie Watkins, how I exist, the simplest model is, which I've already touched on, we can say I'm a body plus a mind. Mind being what we just said. It's clear in the nature of clear light, non-physical, without beginning, without end. It's a stream of consciousness with a physical body. Okay? That's all. There is no permanent soul. There is no self that the body and mind belong to. There is no Robbie that owns these. We just have the temporary union of body with a stream of consciousness continually changing, and we put the label on that, or I put the label on a self. That's me. Okay? I label that as Robbie. That's what, one way the Buddha said we can look at how we exist. There was a book that came out a number of years ago called Thoughts Without a Thinker, which is a great title. There are all these thoughts in the mind, but there is nobody who is having those thoughts. Okay, we think there's a Robbie who these thoughts belong to and is having them. And the Buddha said that's a misconception of reality. There's just a stream of thoughts, a physical body, and that's all that's there. There's no soul. There's no core, unchanging essence. One model of how we exist. A little bit more elaborate model of how we exist is what I talked about last time, which is the five aggregates. It's good to be familiar with these. Probably a good idea to memorize these. This comes up a lot in Buddhism. So what are the five aggregates? Form, feeling, discrimination or perception. What else? Miscellaneous or compositional factors. Compositional factors. And consciousness. Okay. Okay. Form is our physical body, the physical aspect of who we are. Feeling is our instinctive reaction to everything that we come into contact with. I like it, I don't like it, I don't care about it. Okay? It's being attracted to certain things, being repulsed by other things, being indifferent to everything. Said that everything we experience, everything we come into contact with, both exterior and interior, our own thoughts, is accompanied by one of those three feelings. Okay? And what determines which feeling arises when I look at that blue cup? I say, oh, what a nice blue cup. That makes me feel good. That's karma, okay? Our feelings are the result of our past actions of body, speech, and mind that have left imprints on our consciousness, on our stream of consciousness, that are literally determining our current experience, forcing us to experience things as we experience them now. For example, if I really like that blue cup, I cannot sit here and force myself not to like it. Okay, if I am instinctively drawn towards that blue cup, I am under the control of my karma. I don't have a choice about that. When I go to the dentist and they're working on a root canal, and I instinctively say, I do not like this, I can't sit there and just change it and say, oh God, this is great, I love this. That is being, we are the playthings of our karma, of our past actions of body, speech, and mind. Okay? And that's our feelings. Discrimination, this gets to what you were talking about earlier. What was there, a question? Okay, let's go here. Yeah.
So, if you're sitting there in the dentist chair and you're getting the root canal done, you know, nobody really likes having that sort of thing done. So what can you do, you know, if I understand you correctly, this is karma.
Yes.
So what can you do to get through that experience without freaking out?
Okay, yeah, that's good. That's not the subject of this class, but it's a good question. What I'm saying is Buddhism, you know, is not saying you can just sit there and imagine it's blissful and bliss out. You are under the control of that karma. What you can do is what we refer to as thought transformation, Lojong, where you reason with yourself. First thing you do is say, okay, I'm not an innocent victim. This is the result of my past karma, okay, of things I've done in the past. Accept that. You can tell yourself that, well, at least I'm getting rid of that karma now. It could have been a lot worse if it stayed on my mind stream. You can look at why you're so attached to not experiencing pain and what you would do to create the causes not to experience that in the future. Okay, so I don't want to go into it, but it's a whole subject called thought transformation, which is tools we use on our way to Buddhahood. A Buddha doesn't have to do any thought transformation because the Buddha would not have the karma to have a rotten back molar, okay? The Buddha has completely eliminated all that negative karma from her mind stream. So the Buddha is not going to be an experience like that. The Buddha is only going to experience bliss and joy no matter what, okay? But while we're working on the way, we can do what we call thought transformation. And there's lots of books, and that's an easy Buddha subject to look up if you want to, okay? Yeah, the Tibetan name for thought transformation is Lojong, and it's a whole group of text, and they're very practical.
Bobby?
Yeah.
I just wanted to see if we get a clarification. Is feeling a physical or a mental factor?
It's mental, okay? Yeah. This one's physical. Everything else here is mental, is non-physical.
So feeling isn't a sensation.
That's confusing. Yeah, we're talking about the feeling of I like it, I don't like it, I'm indifferent, yeah. Okay? Let's see. Okay, discrimination is what you in the bat mentioned earlier. It's being able to recognize that this is cup and everything else is not cup. Okay, discrimination or perception. It's really the ability to recognize things. Okay, so that's part of who we are. And then compositional factors, the official definition is everything that's left over. Anything else you can think of that's going on in your mind. But karma is a compositional factor. Dreaming is a compositional factor. There are all sorts of non-physical phenomena. So this is a slightly more elaborate model of who we are than just saying we're body and mind. We can say we're made up of the five aggregates that temporarily come together, and they in and of themselves are continuously changing. Our bodies can, I left out consciousness, that's mind, okay, what we're talking about, or awareness. We can say we are just the five aggregates temporarily coming together and then falling apart. And my I've got a good friend who's a Buddhist, and our running joke is how much harder it gets to hold these aggregates together as you get older. You put a lot more effort into trying to keep them together because they all just want to wander off and separate as we get older. Yeah, it takes a lot of work to keep these aggregates going together. Okay, so just another model of how body and mind, five aggregates, okay? They're not contradictory. This is just a little bit more elaborate. Any more comments or questions about that? Okay. Okay, so that's our review of the last couple of weeks. And I wanted to do another meditation now. Yeah. Do you have any of the completion cards? Yeah. Could I have one? Thank you. Begin by checking your posture. And three deep breaths from the abdomen. And take a moment and set your motivation for the meditation to follow. And having set your motivation, now we'll just settle the mind by watching the breath. The mind directly on the breath, bringing it back over and over as necessary. And having settled our mind a little bit, we're going to change the object. We're going to do the meditation that I discussed a little bit earlier. We're just going to watch the thoughts as they arise, exist, and go out of existence in our mind. Just the thoughts that come into my consciousness right now. Just calmly sitting and watching them. It's like a parade going by. We're just watching the parade of thoughts. We're just watching the stream flow by. We're just watching the clouds pass through the sky. Some of the thoughts are pleasant, some are unpleasant, some are neutral. Some seem just totally random out of the blue. Some are memories of something that happened today. some are feelings about what I'm experiencing right now. So just watch the thoughts, one after another. So don't grit your teeth and bear down. Just kind of relax. Just watch what goes through the mind, not getting caught up in any of it, but just watching the parade go by. Thank you. And you can bring your meditation to an end and again do a brief dedication. Let me hear what that meditation was like for some people. Mike over here.
So I had trouble. I'm so accustomed to letting my thoughts go that they're way out there now. I had trouble actually finding my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'm so focused on the breath or whatever.
Yeah.
So I have trouble finding my thoughts. And, I just struggled with it for a while, and I finally just gave up.
Well, the struggle is your thoughts that you're having. If you're struggling, that's a thought frustration or whatever. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Did anyone get a sense of just sitting back and watching the thoughts? Get a sense of that? You know, sometimes people use the phrase, you know, when they meditate, they get rid of all of their thoughts. And from a Buddhist point of view, that's not really possible. You can't get rid of all your thoughts. You can become more aware of them, and you can actually develop some control over them. Did anybody get a sense of it, just randomness of things that came up? Yeah, okay.
Last time I had trouble with this. This time, you know, I kind of relaxed into a little bit more, and it kept saying, my legs hurt, I'm itchy, I'm restless,
mm-hmm.
I need to move, I need, you know, all those different physical things that you think about. Oh, it itches here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a way to start. Yes, that's good. Okay. How many people thought about food? How many people thought about sex? Okay, we're not going to go. The content is not the important thing. Just to get a sense. So I mean, it's pretty shocking though when we watch just how uncontrolled our mind is. The stuff that comes up. I mean, just out of the blue. You know, is there any chance for me to get enlightened? You know, to develop wisdom and compassion when I just have, you know, my mind seems so uncontrolled when we start doing a meditation like that. So now I'm going to talk about another model the Buddha gave us, specifically of the mind and what's going on in the mind. We'll set aside, we're not going to talk about the physical side anymore. We're going to talk just about the mind. I mean, what are these thoughts? Where do they come from? Why do some of them feel good? Some of them feel bad? And this is a big area of Buddhist study called Lo-Rig. Okay. Lo-Jong was thought transformation. This is Lo-Rig. And we're not even going to talk about Lo-Main. We'll just stick with this. And how do we translate Lo-Rig? Who was here on Friday evenings with Venerable George? It's called mind and mental factors. Okay, this is a area study called mind and mental factors. Let's see, who came on Friday nights when Venerable George was here? Can you raise your hand? A couple of people. Okay, so I'm going. He ran through it in 6 Friday nights, and I'm going to run through it in 10 minutes here. Yeah, we'll start it tonight. I just want people to be familiar with this, because this is another model the Buddha gave us to help us start understanding what's going on in our mind. So the Buddha said, you know, say we've got one finger snap, and we've got 65 thoughts that, I'm not going to draw 65 each, they're connected. Each one arises and subsides, one thought after another, one moment of consciousness. And as we start to do a meditation like we just did, you know, they're all over the place. They're memories, emotions, physical sensations, planning, all sorts of stuff. So the Buddha said these, in these Buddha said each one of these moments of consciousness is composed of a primary mind, and I'll define these terms, primary mind plus various mental factors. And how many mental factors are there? Anybody know? 51, according to who? I think as the Sangha said there are 51, Vasubandhu said there are 46. We'll debate that at some point, yeah. But generally when you talk about mental factors, you assume that there are 51, okay? So every moment of consciousness, 65 of them in the snap of a finger, is composed of a primary mind and various ones of these 51 mental factors. Okay, so what is a primary mind? I didn't hear it go to Venerable George's first classes. Did he define primary minds? Anybody remember? Okay. Yeah, the Friday night one. Okay. Yeah, primary mind is a primary cognition. Okay, when they use mind, this is they talk about mind, they're talking about a moment of consciousness. If you listen to the Buddhist teachings, it sounds like he's saying we have thousands and thousands of minds. That term is used primarily just to mean a moment of consciousness or awareness or cognition. So a primary mind is a primary cognition established by means of its apprehension of the fundamental presence of the object. Yeah, A primary cognition established by means of its apprehension of the fundamental presence of the object. Okay, anybody want to take a stab in translating that into understandable English? A primary cognition established by means of its apprehension of the fundamental presence of the object. So there's an object. The primary mind is established by apprehending, by becoming aware of it, of its fundamental presence. So what this is just, what we're saying, what he's saying here is this is just very blank, uninfected, unaffected, uninflected perception. Okay? Just, you know, not just direct perception of the cup. Okay? Without even thinking about it. Without even, I like the cup, I don't like the cup is blue, I wonder how old the cup is, how did the cup get here? Oh, it has some nice cool water in it. Just a very, very simple perception of cup. Okay, a very simple perception of marker. A very simple perception of, you know, it could be a memory.
Is that before
determination? Very, not even labeled, okay, just a direct, non-judgmental, not just direct perception, okay? Primary mind, okay? The object, consciousness apprehends the object, and that establishes, that's the primary mind, that's established, okay? At the same time as the primary mind, various mental factors are added to it, okay? The mental factors are what give it its color, its emotional content, its all sorts of things, and we'll see what these are. These various ones are the 51 mental factors, okay? The mental factors have 5 similarities with the primary mind. This is pretty technical, and you don't need to write this down. I'm just go through this. The primary mind and the mental factors have the same basis. They're both based on the same phenomena. I can't have a primary mind perceiving a cup and mental factors related to this clock, okay? The same duration. The primary mind and the mental factors last for the same length of time. They have the same aspect. It means they're perceiving the same qualities of the cup. They have the same, what's referred to as the referent, in that they're both dealing with the same object, and these seem to overlap, so don't worry about them. And they have the same substance, in that they can both be accurate or they can both be inaccurate. So this is every moment of these 65 moments, everyone is a primary mind with various mental factors related to an object. The object can be something physical, it can be a thought, it can be an emotion, it can be a memory, it can be another person. Okay? And that's where all these seemingly random thoughts with their various emotional charge come from that we see when we're sitting and watching our thoughts. Because what causes the various mental factors to arise? Karma, again. Okay? This is, again, another way, this is the same way that we're under the influence of karma. Okay? The fact that certain mental factors seem to arise over and over again and others don't is the result of karma. Okay? So, I'm going to start listing the 51 mental factors. I think I'm only going to list the first five tonight, because the first five are referred to as the ever-present mental factors. Let's see. Okay. There are five ever-present mental factors. So that means with every moment of consciousness, these five mental factors are always there. Five ever-present. So these five are there for every one of the 65 moments of consciousness. Okay, and these are somewhat like the five aggregates in some way. There's feeling, okay, which again is like, don't care about. Okay, there is discernment. Discernment. Which is the same thing as discrimination or perception that we discussed in the aggregates. Next one is referred to as intention. This is a very interesting one. This is what draws my consciousness to the cup. Okay? And it said this is how we create, Geshe Rabtan said that is karma. Intention is karma. That's an interesting thought. Okay, there's contact, which means the connection between my consciousness and the object. Okay, connects the object and the mind. The mind and the object meet. And there's attention, which is actually holding on to the cup. So intention leads to contact. Intention is the movement of the mind towards the object. Contact is the actual meeting with it. Attention is staying with that. Okay? So these five mental factors are present in every moment of consciousness, along with the primary mind, which just grossly perceives undifferentiated. There is always feeling, discernment, intention, contact, and attention. Okay? Those are the first five mental factors. Those are omnipresent, always present. They're present in every moment of consciousness. The feeling can be positive or negative. Discernment allows us to recognize it. Intention is the movement of the mind here towards the cup. The movement of the mind towards a moment of anger. The movement of the mind towards a moment of compassion. Okay, if it's a mental object that we're perceiving. Contact is the union of the mind with the object, and attention is the staying on the object for that moment of consciousness. So it's a very kind of, some people could say it's just splitting hairs, okay, just splitting moments of consciousness. But I'm going to stop there with those five omnipresent mental factors, and then we'll run through the other 46 really quickly in 2 weeks. But the other 46 there, positive ones and negative ones, and you will recognize a lot of them. But they're what give these moments of consciousness their emotional charge, their flavor, okay, what makes them tasty. When we go from just the primary mind that just grossly perceives something, then we pile all these mental factors on, okay, and start to conceptualize, you could say. Yes, question, comment here.
By ever-present, do you mean simultaneous?
Yeah, these five are all simultaneous with the primary mind.
Then I think that explains why it seemed to me as though I had multiple thoughts at the same time.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. So you're different aspects of one thought. Mm-hmm. Comment?
I'm getting really confused. It seems like a lot of different definitions of mind and consciousness. Like, I'm thinking you talked about primary mind. Is that like very subtle mind?
Okay. Yeah, let me clear. That's a good question. When we're using it here in this sense only, primary mind is that direct, undifferentiated perception. Okay. This is a different model. Okay. It doesn't contradict the others. So I'm not using it mind in the terms of consciousness. I'm using mind in the sense of a moment of consciousness, okay? And they use the word mind there, and it is a little bit confusing, okay? So it just means a direct perception of a phenomena. Okay, just think about it. I'm not using mind there in the sense of consciousness. Yeah, this is little mind as opposed to big mind. Yeah, a lot of definitions and lots of lists.
The middle.
Okay. And yeah, I think we're out of time. Okay, so make sure you have a copy of the completion card. I would like you to do the meditation on space-like clarity of the mind again this week, because I think that's an important one. All of this action that we're talking about here occurs in the space-like clarity of the mind. So do that meditation again for this, in the next 2 weeks, actually, six times a week. If you want to vary it with just watching the thoughts, that's fine, but do one or the other of those for the next 2 weeks. For some reason, meditation on precious human rebirth is on this completion card, and I don't want to do that one in this class. It's kind of not the way the direction this class will go. Then next week we'll do a brief overline, or the week after next, a brief overview of the rest of the mental factors. And there are a few more things I want to talk about, and then the last class will be primarily meditation. Okay. Oh, do you have any idea, Joanna? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Maybe y'all can talk. Yeah. Afterwards. Okay. Yes. Where the yes, it's the readings are at online learning all small case .fpmt.org, and then you go to Discovering Buddhism, and you want the first module, Mind is Potential, and you have to set up an account with a password. And then the key to get in is clear light. Yeah. Okay, one word. Yeah.
I noticed that the lectures are
Mm-hmm.
So where do I find the path?
See, the lecture's there. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. See y'all in 2 weeks. Anybody who shows up next Monday night flunks the course. Because you weren't aware.